This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Few subjects in American history have been as relentlessly scrutinized as the Kennedy assassination. But a new book by my guest, journalist David Talbot, looks at the question of whether Kennedy was the victim of a conspiracy in Dallas from a unique perspective, that of the president's brother, Robert Kennedy. Talbot says it's clear Bobby Kennedy never believed Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone in Dallas, and Talbot's book argues his suspicions were well-founded. It focuses on the Kennedy brothers' partnership in the White House and contends they were constantly undermined and threatened by forces in the military, the CIA, the mafia, and the Cuban exile community. The administration was, Talbot argues, a government at war with itself. David Talbot worked for years as a writer and editor in several publications and is the founder of the online magazine Salon.com. His new book is Brothers: The Hidden History of the Kennedy Years. Well, David Talbot, welcome back to Fresh Air. You open this book with an account of Bobby Kennedy's movements and reaction in November 1963 to his brother's shooting in Dallas. Did Bobby Kennedy have an immediate belief or theory about who had killed President Kennedy?
Yes, literally, immediately. That afternoon, he happened to be at his home in Virginia at Hickory Hill, the old Civil War estate where he and his family lived. And it was J. Edgar Hoover, of all people, who phoned him that day, his archenemy, the head of the FBI, to tell him that his brother had been shot, and then soon after that his brother had died. And Bobby immediately, we know, from the phone calls and conversations he's having that day from his home, immediately suspects that Lee Harvey Oswald is not the complete story. And he immediately is looking into the shadowy war against Castro that is being run by the CIA and has enlisted gangsters in its attempts to kill Castro as the source of the plot against his own brother.
Well, and of course, Bobby had made a lot of enemies in the underworld for many years by investigating the mob and the Teamsters Union. Did he do anything to investigate the crime, Bobby Kennedy?
He did. And this is the great, of course, drama of the story that I tell, because publicly what Bobby is saying, of course, is that he accepts the official version of Dallas, the Warren Report. But privately, it's a very different story. Privately, he's a man on fire to get to the bottom of the story from that afternoon on. And he's looking himself into various leads. He's using surrogates, former FBI agent named Walter Sheridan, who was his right-hand investigator, a number of people on his staff who he trusted, to pursue every lead. And literally, he goes from New Orleans to Chicago to Dallas to Mexico to Moscow, either himself or using these surrogates, these aides, to pursue every lead that he can.
You mentioned that he dispatched someone to Moscow. What was that all about?
Well, that's a remarkable story. This is a week after the assassination of President Kennedy. He goes to a close family friend named William Walton. Now, Walton is a very interesting character in his own right. He was a Time magazine war correspondent during World War II, knew the eldest Kennedy brother, Joe Kennedy, before his death in the war. He'd gotten to know Jack Kennedy as a young congressman and Jackie Kennedy in Georgetown before they moved into the White House. And he was used as a confidential emissary and a political operative by the Kennedy family for a number of years. He had been due to go to Moscow a week after the assassination as part of JFK's efforts towards détente with the Soviet Union. He was going to lead an artistic exchange mission to Moscow. He thought the mission would be canceled after Dallas, but Bobby and Jackie Kennedy both go to Walton and say, no, go ahead with this mission and take a confidential message from us, the Kennedy family, to the Soviet government. He does that, and he meets with a Soviet agent named Georgi Bolshakov, who both Jack and Bobby had come to trust while he was an agent in Washington. They used him as a back-channel courier to Khrushchev in the Kremlin. And Walton has dinner with Bolshakov in Moscow, and he tells him a remarkable thing. He says, we don't blame you, the Soviets, for the assassination, even though Oswald is being portrayed in the press at that point as a communist agent. We know that it was a domestic high-level political conspiracy that killed the president, and Bobby Kennedy intends to run for president at some point, and when he does, if he succeeds, he will resume the policies of President Kennedy's of détente towards the Soviet Union. Well, I find this a stunning, of course, story because this is the height of the Cold War. And at this point, it indicates that Bobby Kennedy and the family are placing more trust in the Soviet government than in their own government.
Publicly, he endorsed the findings of the Warren Commission that Oswald acted alone, right?
That's right.
And I was struck by one fascinating detail you discovered, that Kenny O'Donnell, who was the special assistant to President Kennedy, who was actually played by Kevin Costner in the movie 13 Days, he was in the motorcade in Dallas and felt strongly that President Kennedy took shots from in front, from the grassy knoll, not from behind where Oswald was, sniper's perch was. But Bobby Kennedy instructed him to lie to the Warren Commission.
Well, that's what I suspect. It's a very revealing story. As you say, Kenny O'Donnell's riding 10 feet behind the president's limousine in Dallas with another White House aide named Dave Powers. These are part of Kennedy's so-called Irish mafia, very loyal aides. Now, both of these men, Kenny O'Donnell and Dave Powers, had been World War II veterans. They knew the sound of gunfire, and they distinctly heard gunfire, they later said, and they told the FBI this, and they told Bobby Kennedy this, both from the grassy knoll area as well as from behind, as you say, the Texas Book Depository. Well, of course, that immediately indicates there was a conspiracy if you have two sharpshooters. But Kenny O'Donnell, I think, was prepared to tell the truth to the Warren Commission, as Dave Powers was. But I do believe it was not just the FBI who told him that he didn't want to go there, which they did. But it was probably Bobby, because I think Kenny O'Donnell was so loyal to Bobby that he would have taken orders only from him. And at this point, Bobby Kennedy has determined he has no power, no official power, even though he's still attorney general, to pursue this crime. The new president, Lyndon Johnson, loathes him. The head of the FBI, which is taking the lead in the investigation into the assassination, J. Edgar Hoover, also has a poisonous relationship with Bobby Kennedy. His power to investigate the crime begins to evaporate from the moment his brother dies. He knows that he has to wait, bide his time, which is what he tells people. He tells his family that weekend in the White House, a very dramatic scene where he begins to confide in family members who are gathering for the funeral of the president. This is what's happened. It's a high-level plot. It involves elements of the government, but we can't do anything until we get back to the White House and we have the machinery of the federal government to investigate this.
Let me just go back to that. You're saying that Bobby Kennedy, you know for a fact that he told members of his family the weekend after the assassination that this was a conspiracy. How do we know that?
We know this from people who were in the White House that weekend, including Peter Lawford, who was the president's brother-in-law. Peter Lawford is dead. I interviewed a close friend of his who reported this to me. And we know from other people that Bobby is saying the same thing during that period.
Well, I want to talk about some of the events in the Kennedy administration that gave rise to the suspicions about the assassination. President Kennedy faced a huge test, a disaster early on, and that was the Bay of Pigs invasion in 1961. This was, of course, for those too young to recall, a CIA-backed invasion of Cuban exiles who were going to overthrow Castro, which quickly turned into a disaster when the invasion force was pinned down on a Cuban beach. And there was enormous pressure from within the Cuban community and the military on Kennedy to bring U.S. military forces into the conflict, in effect, to join in an invasion of the island. He resisted and refused. And, of course, the invasion force was taken captive and the whole thing was a big fiasco. What was the effect of Kennedy's reputation among the military and intelligence services? How was it affected by the Bay of Pigs disaster?
Well, I think it's at this point in the Kennedy administration, and it's quite early on. It's only a matter of a few months into the administration in April 1961. It's at this point when I believe the government cracked, that you have essentially a government at war with itself from that point on, because Kennedy's own national security apparatus now decides that Kennedy is weak and can't be trusted. They had thought, as you say, that he would have gone in and reinforced the beleaguered Cuban exiles pinned down on the beaches, that he would have brought massive U.S. military power to bear. And indeed, I believe they knew that the invasion itself, the initial invasion, would be a fiasco, and they thought they would be able to sandbag Kennedy into sending in the full might of the U.S. military. Kennedy came to that same conclusion himself, and he was enraged. He vowed to shatter the CIA into 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the winds. While the head of the CIA, Alan Dulles, the legendary spymaster, and others began muttering darkly among themselves and the military that Kennedy was in over his head. He couldn't be trusted. He wasn't the leader that America needed.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of these ranking officials in the military. You know, in 2007, it's a little hard to recall kind of the intensity of that Cold War period and the threat of, you know, nuclear war hanging over the nation. Were there military leaders who seriously wanted to provoke a new nuclear confrontation with the Soviets?
Yes, there were. And in particular, the head of the Air Force, General Curtis LeMay, a World War II hero. Robert McNamara, Kennedy's Secretary of Defense, had worked under him in Japan during the war. And Curtis LeMay did indeed feel that the country not only could but should launch a preemptive nuclear strike against the Soviet Union. The United States at that point had overwhelming nuclear superiority. And he felt that if you're going to fight a nuclear war with the Soviets, and he felt it was inevitable, that you should fight it sooner rather than later when the Soviets would begin to catch up with the United States. And in fact, he had this debate with Defense Secretary McNamara. He felt that you could win a nuclear war if you had more nuclear weapons than your enemy at the end of the Holocaust, whereas McNamara argued that you had to take into account the casualties and, of course, the devastation that would ensue.
You also write that a lot of the military structure, not just Curtis LeMay, but a lot of people in the military held really hardline anti-communist views and openly criticized the president as an appeaser. I mean, this is sort of shocking for those of us who are used to thinking of the military as being under civilian control. It was a different world then.
A very different world. The U.S. military was very politicized. There were political rallies, anti-communist rallies, held in a number of places throughout the country in which active duty military officers would participate. General Edwin Walker, who was a very respected military commander in West Germany at the time, distributed John Birch, you know, far-right material to his troops in the ranks. He advised them how to vote in American elections, and he considered all liberal democratic candidates socialists and treasonous. This man finally was forced out of the military and became an arch enemy of the Kennedys and campaigned against the Kennedys all around the country. But the mutinous atmosphere within the American military became so alarming to JFK himself that at one point he approaches a friend in Hollywood, John Frankenheimer, the director, and he urges him to make a movie version of the best-selling novel 7 Days in May, which, of course, was about an attempted military coup in Washington. He does this, I believe, to not only as a warning shot across his general's bow, but also to try and awaken the American people to the threat, the growing threat against democracy at that point.
Did Kennedy truly believe a military coup was possible?
I believe he was concerned about it. You know, it's remarkable when you see transcripts of conversations in the White House, and of course he had a taping system, so we have some of these conversations verbatim, and conversations he had with close friends, how often the subject of assassination or coup, the violent specter of the end of his own presidency, would come up in these conversations.
Give us an example.
I don't believe,
of that. Yeah.
Well, one day he's sailing with an old friend, Red Fay, who he'd appointed Assistant Secretary of the Navy. And Fay has been reading 7 Days in May, the book, and brings it up and says, "Do you think something like that could ever happen here, Jack?" And JFK, instead of just dismissing it out of hand, says, "Well, you know, if there were a shock to the system, something like the Bay of Pigs, people in, you know, the military might begin to wonder about the president, particularly if the president's young and untested," which, of course, JFK was. "Then if there's another shock after that, and maybe possibly a third one, yes, there might be elements within the military," he tells his friend, "that would move against the White House at that point out of a sense of national duty." And I believe he felt he was, of course, JFK had very finely tuned political radar. He picked up on these tremors within his own government. And I believe in conversations like this, he is expressing those concerns.
So what you have is a situation where you have this hotbed of of angry anti-Castro Cubans in South Florida who regard Kennedy as a traitor for not supporting them at the Bay of Pigs. You have CIA operatives, rogues who were doing things without the knowledge of the government, in league with the mafia, who have their own reasons to hate Kennedy. So you have three forces that are angry enough at President Kennedy to give rise to suspicion once President Kennedy is assassinated that they might have been behind it. And there are lots of fascinating connections we can't go into here among a lot of the players. But I have to ask you one thing. You know, mob historians who followed the mafia, one thing that they tell us is that they generally want to operate and make their money. And over the years, they've historically not killed cops or prosecutors. That was off limits. What makes us believe that they would actually order a hit on a president?
Well, let me just say, very emphatically, I don't believe the mafia were the ultimate intellectual architects behind this crime, behind the assassination of President Kennedy. And nor did, I believe, Bobby feel that way. He was looking more, as I say, at the CIA and elements of his own government. But I do believe the mafia played a role, and I do believe Bobby Kennedy thought that as well. You know, within 24 hours of Jack Ruby, the Dallas nightclub operator who shoots Lee Harvey Oswald down on national television, within 24 hours of that shocking crime, Bobby has investigators looking into who Jack Ruby is, and they report back to him immediately that he's not just a patriotic American who felt terrible about what had happened to the president and was shooting Oswald out of his sense of grief. This is a man who was basically a low-level mafia errand boy, and Bobby Kennedy knew this. Bobby Kennedy tells his press secretary years later, Frank Mankiewicz, when I saw the phone records of all the people Jack Ruby was calling before Dallas, before the assassination, it looked like my witness list for the Senate Rackets Committee. So Bobby's putting together how the mafia played a role in it, but my sense is that he believed it was a high-level political plot that had utilized the mafia in some way to carry out certain roles within the operation.
You know, most, if not all, of the players who would have firsthand information about the assassination are now dead. Is there fresh source material that's still hidden that might be mined for new clues about the assassination?
Yes, there is. And it began actually in the 1970s with the Church Committee investigation into the CIA and the House Select Committee on Assassinations later in the 70s. Many of the areas that Bobby Kennedy was looking into, again, were stirred up by these investigations, the CIA's war on Castro, the gangsters, militant exiles, and a number of the people who played a role in those investigations, who came under suspicion, we could learn more about today. As a result of a bill that was passed in 1992 because of the Oliver Stone film, JFK, thousands of government documents were released, but the CIA continues to sit on many of these documents. And in fact, they're going to court this summer against a Washington Post reporter named Jeff Morley, who's played, I think, a heroic role in trying to get to the bottom of the case. And he's trying to get the agency to release records on some of these men, in particular a man named George Ioannidis, who we now know was tied to Lee Harvey Oswald in the early 60s before the assassination.
Ioannidis was a CIA man, right?
That's right. Ioannidis was the CIA official in charge of a Cuban student exile group that was tangling with Oswald and had some mysterious interaction with him. We know that another CIA official, David Phillips, before he died, intimated that he was the CIA's one of the CIA's handlers for Lee Harvey Oswald. So it goes on and on. Howard Hunt, who recently died, the legendary Watergate burglar who was, again, part of the CIA's war on Castro, he revealed to his son, his eldest son, before he died, that he was asked to come to a meeting at a CIA safe house in Miami where the plot to kill the president was discussed. There's a lot of curious things about this, and there's no good reason for them to continue to sit on this. This is American history, and Americans have a right to their history. And I hope that they finally see that these documents should be released.
Well, David Talbot, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Dave.
Journalist David Talbot founded the online magazine Salon.com. His new book is Brothers, The Hidden History of the Kennedy Years.